What's up, everybody? Welcome to Declarations of War. Host for this evening, myself, Alexei of Card, my faithful co-host, Ninja Turtle.
Hello.
The returning sort of co-host when they decide to show up, Celine.
Greetings.
And Fang.
Hello, hello.
Both from Mercenary Coalition. Celine, of course, former CSM chairman, founder of Mercenary Coalition, dank pilot in his own right when he figures out how to log in. And Fang is probably one of the dankest leaders we have in MC at the moment. He's pretty much the man when our Saber A is not available. Very excited to have them both back in the show.
I'll have you note that I did leave the kill board for the first 2 weeks of the campaign before I went on vacation. Just saying!
Leading the campaign in the first 2 weeks of the campaign is not a huge... the hugest bragging point right there. I mean, it was pretty much a shit show. We'll get into that. We had our first major campaign. It was rough, rocky. We pulled it out. We'll tell you all the highlights later on in the show. But first, some shout-outs. I want to give a shout-out to Nora's directors, Ark, Gabriel, Greb, Del, Killa, even Cassidy. Yeah, they really are the better angels of my nature. And they work really hard to make sure that everything in Noir runs smoothly. Wouldn't be able to do it without them. So, thanks, guys.
I want to give a shout-out to everyone in the Pandemic family that is playing fantasy football. We have like a half dozen leagues in-house this year. It's a good time, so... Yeah, I don't know.
Right?
It's Sunday. Are you ready for some football?
I am indeed ready for some football, presently. Celine, you got any shout-outs?
Just to pretty much the logistics guys in Mercenary Coalition. It's it would have been a hell of a lot harder without all of their hard work. And it's been interesting to watch the Alliance kind of stand up from nothing several months ago to where it is today and see that the logistic arm is... easily equal to or even better than a lot of more established alliances. Those guys have really done an incredible job in a short amount of time.
Hear, hear. Fang?
I'd like to give a shout out to CCP this week for giving me all these delicious dev blogs and changes and stuff to look at after I came back from my holidays. So yeah, thank you, CCP.
And of course, we will be going into those in great detail as well. A lot of stuff going on in EVE right now. It's kind of blowing up in certain ways, but of course, anything that's different is, you know, people are view it with skepticism. There's going to be some transitions, some upheavals. We're already seeing the rage on the forums, and let's get into it. We'll talk about the poll in a second. Let's get right into EVE news. So we talked a little bit in the last show about CCP rolling back some of the VB changes and, you know, sort of nerfing the difficulty of Aegis Sov to hold. Well, they've got two more follow-ups. The one is that Citadels are not going to be Entosisable. They will be more like Passes in that you'll have to use guns to take them out. That's the major change. There are a few other more minor changes in there. They're still debating whether or not weapons are going to be on or not on. I think they're leaning toward not on. You actually have to be there to use them. I think that's pretty cool. What do you guys think about Citadels in general? We haven't really talked about it on the show with Fang and Celine here. What do you guys think about the Citadels in general? And what do you think about the backpedal to the use guns instead of the Entosis module change?
Well, I think it's an idea that's long overdue in general. It's something that should have been in the game about 5 years ago. But, of course, CCP got distracted by other things and decided to put their resources into expansions that didn't quite focus on the core gameplay. With Citadels, what you're seeing now is kind of the original promise of Dominion starting to be made real. And... what you're seeing right now in EVE is basically 50% of phase one of a three-phase plan. And citadels are a big part of that because it will give everybody from individual players all the way up to giant, huge coalitions of alliances something to strive for and call their own. I don't think that the three classes of citadels that they've announced are going to be the only types of these structures that you're going to see. They've already talked a bit about where this is going to eventually lead, which is going to be Stargate construction, other large-scale type of projects that will need everything from just a few people all the way up to groups of alliances and all their resources to build and control and protect or destroy. And with regard to the backpedal, I think that it's indicative of the fact that when they introduced the Entosis Link, they introduced something that was very scalable at its core. It's a very clever idea, but in their most recent dev blog, they acknowledge what a lot of players have been saying, which is that it's kind of ridiculous to solve laser a giant structure into destruction. There is a visceral feel that's missing whenever you don't need to apply damage to something in order to blow it up. So them bringing it up to be them changing their minds to be to have damage applied is a very smart move. I've seen a couple of articles on this where people have been discussing the fact that since they're talking about doing it this way, that maybe there's a way to combine the Entosis mechanic with the damage mechanics. And I've seen a few ideas about that that seem pretty smart. And I don't see why they couldn't find a way to somehow combine the two depending upon how they intend to scale the system. But I've seen more in the past week or so in terms of communication that leads me to think that they're actually going to move this in a positive direction and really respond to player feedback that I have in quite some time. The dev blog from CCPC Seagull especially included a video where you could actually see her talking and hear the excitement in her voice for all of the stuff that she's not even able to talk to us about yet. That's a very good PR move. So, they've misstepped a lot, but I think that they're steering things back on course, and I think that people need to calm down and not be so reactionary to some of these things because, as I said, we're only seeing the beginning of a very, very large plan, and these things take time, and CCP doesn't seem like they're going to be rushed into doing it all at once, which is a smart move, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there. Fang, what's your take?
Okay, well, firstly, I think that when we look at the citadels, especially from the perspective of existing players, the existing mechanics, the existing meta, there's a lot for players to be unhappy about. And you'll see that coming through in the forums, especially people who are, one-man industrial outfits saying, oh, how am I going to defend my citadel? Or even mid to large scale alliances, complaining about having to actually be there to defend it, things like this. But when we look at it in terms of actually the game as a whole, so if we can actually remove ourselves from the equation and stop looking at it from the point of view of how is it going to hurt us directly, these are all good changes. I mean, first of all, for example, no one likes to rep pauses. It used to be a very common thing that in my previous lines we would talk about that in the battle for R64 moons. If someone reinforced one of our R64s, we wouldn't even turn up to rep it. Just let them take it. We'll just show up and take it back off them because shooting a POS is a lot less boring than repping a POS. So the idea that here that citadels can repair themselves, for example, I think is brilliant. I think it's exactly right. I think repping ops should die a death for the most part. I think that the complex vulnerability timers, again, I think it's excellent. Rather than forcing people to be online every single day at a certain time, which means that if you miss one day, you're screwed. But the idea of weekly vulnerability windows, I think, is excellent. And it allows people to actually defend these structures realistically and still have a, you know, real life and so on and so forth. As for the specifics of entosis versus damage, I don't have any particular religious affiliation here, and I'm not convinced on either side. I think both approaches have their pros and cons, as Celine was hinting at already, and that maybe a hybrid approach is best, or maybe just keep them as structures that you shoot, because we like shooting things, and we have large ships with big guns like dreadnoughts and supers that can do these kinds of things.
Yeah, I will say that this does keep dreads back in the fold as more than just an escalation against carriers, which is cool.
Exactly.
My big worry is not so much what's in this directly, but what is hinted at it toward the end. Eventually, they're going to move a lot of the sovereignty stuff away from outposts, iHubs, etc., and put them into these citadels. They've said that numerous times. And my concern is, you know, is that like a backdoor way to move us back to an HP-based SOV system, which, for numerous reasons, is not a good idea.
I'm thinking that, based on what we've seen so far, and the fact that they do have this new entosising mechanic, it would seem like the smart move would be to, okay, you can blow up these structures and all this other stuff, but they've also got, you know, the multiple capture points and all these other stuff, all these other things that are in place using the entosis mechanic. If CCP is smart, they'll definitely find a way to combine these two things, and you can have, you know, like these giant citadels and all these things to, you know, secure the base of your power, but not necessarily tie the destruction of one to the actual flag over the system. And I haven't seen anything in the devlogs that would indicate that they're going to take that step, that they're going to tie the structures themselves to the actual sovereignty. And I hope that they don't do that.
Yeah, I hope that they don't.
I think they explicitly said they weren't going to, that it wasn't going to affect the Aegis SOV system.
But it does say we have plans to merge those systems when we move sovereignty into the new structures, and we will account for the specific needs of agent sovereignty when that happens. So, I mean, the best case scenario, I think, is that, you know, the SOV structures will, you know, the SOV citadels will be entosisable. And I think the medium case is that they will be both entosisable and shootable. And perhaps there's some kind of breakpoint by which it is faster to entosis than to DPS or vice versa. I think the worst case scenario is that, you know, they just can the entosis for these modules all together and just put entosis on the nodes or something like that.
Yeah, there's a couple of other fantastic things about these citadels. One is that, going back to how it was in the old days, they use fuel depending on what you have online. You know, but back in the old days, PARs would only consume as much fuel depending on how much power grid and CPU you had fitted to the PARs. And the citadels will be like that, which I think is great. And again, so it allows people who are just getting into the game to run one of these things, try it out, and not pay the full fuel cost compared to someone who's doing a lot in it or has a lot of eggs in that basket and therefore wants to defend it, therefore it's going to cost more fuel. I think that's good. The other thing which I think is really big is the you know, we may have talked about this in the last podcast, I can't remember, but the idea that if you do put your eggs in this basket and then you lose the basket, that you're basically paying a tax to get back at your assets. So you're not losing everything. You know, because again, there's a lot of concern that, what's going to happen? You know, if I can't log in, am I going to lose all my stuff? And the short answer is, unless it's in a wormhole, you're probably not going to lose all your stuff, because you can just have the stuff delivered to another station and pay this tax. And then the final thing, which is related to that, and I can't remember, so I'll shut up with that.
Are we not at all worried with that particular issue, though, that it sort of takes away a lot of the risk of Eve, sort of a change and a very long string of changes that would contribute to inflation? I mean, you're not going to get loot off this thing. You'll have to pay a little money, but your items will still be there. You know, you're not really taking any risk by putting one of these things down.
Oh, you say you're not getting loot. If you have industry drops running, for example, and you kill, if you kill a citadel that was running industry jobs, you get, I believe, a proportion of the input materials for that industry job. That's better than right now.
Oh yeah, there's going to be loot. I mean, I remember somewhere, and this, even in the base design.
I don't think that's better than now. When you crack a POS now, you have a chance of getting whatever's in the corp hangar, whatever's in the ship maintenance array.
And that's still the case, isn't it?
Well, not as far as I understand it.
Not for the citadel stuff, no.
Okay, no, but okay, but in the specific case of an industry pause, you definitely stand to gain a lot more. And there are some pretty shiny industry pauses out there. But yeah,
I'm fairly certain
with one hand and giving with the other.
I'm fairly certain I saw somewhere that if you blow up a citadel, there is going to be loot. If not, then that's retarded. I mean, like, extremely retarded.
Let's see. I feel safe in Citadel City. Continue to talk amongst yourselves. I'll look this up.
No, that's the one. Go back to that one.
Yeah, so
it explains how shit just goes back to, like, stations and stuff. They reversed the one on wormholes now, so wormhole stuff will drop like a normal loot, but out in, like, K-Space? Uh-uh.
Yeah, so the final thing that I wanted to comment on, which I just remembered, is this idea that, yes, you've got to be there to use the guns to defend your citadel. Your citadel will not necessarily defend itself, although again, that's something that they're debating, I'm sure, in the CSM. But that when you do defend it, it's meaningful. So it's like piloting a ship. It's not like, you know, using a pea shooter to try and pling at a few ships that the enemy can just sort of shirk off.
All right, so here's the deal. A percentage of the materials used to construct the citadel will drop, as well as ongoing industry stuff. The structure module and defenses that are being, you know, a thing that are like in there, they will also drop for the loot under ship loot rules. However, all player personal assets like corporate hangars and all that kind of stuff, all the ships, personal assets, etc., are all transferred back to safety.
So
and you'll have to pay a 10% of the value to get it back.
Bring a hauler.
And again, to be clear, 10% of the value, not to the player that killed it, but just to like
to
CCP,
tax,
basically.
To CCP. But what that means is, in the case where you were sieging some pause that had a ton of ships in it that someone had forgotten about, yes, you get a lot less under the new system. But in the case of that it was just an empty pause, which, let's face it, most pauses that get killed are just empty, in inverted commas, pauses, then you'll actually get more, because you'll get the percentage of the mineral cost. And if it was an industry pause, you stand to gain quite heavily.
Yes.
But yes, you'll need a hauler. You'll need a freighter.
No, absolutely. If it's completely empty POS, you're getting more. But I think tactically it raises an interesting question, which is you can now have an entire alliance basically staging out of one of these things. And if it just is destroyed, they're only out 10% of the value of what they put in there. The actual ships and stuff will be perfectly fine. Cool with that?
Well, it depends on what these things actually cost to build. I mean, in the
XLs are 15.
Which they've announced.
XLs are 15 bill.
Yeah, 15 bill for an XL. It's not a small amount.
It's less than an outpost. Pretty chump change for most alliances.
God, then I hope they scale that up, because number one, it looks like it should cost more than 15 bill. It is less than an outpost. Wow. Okay.
I think the reason why they are doing this, and I think the reason why we should be okay with it, is the fallout, the rage on the forums, if they said, you're going to lose all your stuff, would be too heavy. I think that's fine.
I'm not worried about that. What I'm saying is that the structure itself, if you're going to put this giant, huge fucking thing in space that you can dock super capitals inside of, I mean, I'm fine with the, you know, the asset return mechanic and all these other things. But if you are going to be able to, I was sitting there thinking to myself, well, God, if I can dock my super carrier and my Titan inside this thing and then fit it with modules and all this other stuff, there's a lot of space-rich people out there, and if you're going to build one of these things for a group of alliances, come out with a 100, 200 bill for something like that size, that's not that difficult. And as Alec was saying, if you manage to blow one of these things up, if everybody's going to get most of their personal assets back and everything else, it should hurt a little. It should hurt somehow. It should, I mean, blowing one of these things up should cost some money. I mean, granted,
well, it costs you 10%. It costs you 10% of whatever, like, you had in there. So, yeah, you can put your Titan in there, like, have fun paying 10% of that. You can put your Super in there, have fun paying 10% of that.
That's 20 bill? That's chump change to alliances like Pandemic.
I'm not even talking about the stuff. I'm not talking about people's stuff. I'm talking about the structure itself that the alliance owns or that the corporation owns.
But the question is, can an alliance stage out of one of these? Isn't the idea that they would have multiple? They would need to have multiple because things like the market service is something that you fit to the Citadel that will consume resources. That was my impression. So my impression was that rather than having a single outpost in a system, because remember, there's no limit to these things. They're not limited by moons. You would have several to do the different functions. You'd have one which is like where people dock and where they trade through the market. Then you might have a different one for reactions in industry. Then you might have another one for, you know, strategic assets that's like a heavy MR staging pause that we know today. So isn't it that there'd be several of them?
Well, even if it is, that's not
still too
horrifically different than how things are now. I mean, I guess part of this is it's not clear what the trade-offs are going to be configuring these things. Like, are you going to be able to do a market one that also has the like PvP docking ability and like pretty much everything you would need to like one-stop shop a deployment?
Now wait a minute. Now that I think of it. Wasn't there a line in one of those dev blogs, I think the first one, where they might have said something to the effect of that the structure itself, it doesn't cost that much, but the modules that you fit to it, or the upgrades that you fit to it, that's where the real money was going to be. If that's the case, then I retract my earlier statement. I'm sorry. It makes more sense if that's the way to do it.
I don't recall that, but I mean, obviously those modules are going to cost something in addition. I don't know. I don't think it's been made clear exactly how much.
For medium rigs will not be that expensive. XL rigs will have the same price magnitude than outpost improvement and upgrades. So they are not something to be easily dismissed. How much does outpost and improvement upgrades cost?
I'll say like 5 to 10.
I could have told you 7 or 8 years ago when I was upgrading my outposts, but I can't.
I think an egg is about 60 billion. Is that about right?
No. 20 to 23 is what I remember, but maybe it's gone up since.
It's about 20.
And then the different upgrades that you can get are about 5 each. Is that
right? It might be like 5, 7.5, 10, or 5, 10, 15. I'm not 100% sure about those really high tier upgrades.
Yeah, so potentially, I mean, if we take the middle number of the three that you gave and say 10, there are 3 rigs, that's 30 billion rigs on top of the 15 that cost to build it. So then it becomes 45, which is comparable to the outpost kind of cost.
Yeah, it's about 15 for the max level, the monument upgrade.
So, you know, if we read between the lines on this dev blog, to me it feels like they are saying the rigs is where the money is.
And okay. All this is going to be subject to change. I mean, they're going to scale it up or down based on feedback. So we'll see.
I guess it will lead to these things being used more, because I think psychologically the thought of losing whatever is more intimidating to people than the actual price tag of the structure. There's just something about like things being lost out of your hangar, your personal hangar, your corporate hangar, that drives people nuts. Whereas, okay, well, we'll put this outpost down. Like, that's not as intimidating for them. Like, it's fixed cost. You know what it's going to be. You know, you can sort of write it off in your brain and not have to worry about, like, some sort of phantom situation where somebody put, like, 500 Deimos in their hangar. And it's like, oh, no, I put 500 Deimos in my hangar. They're all going to be gone now. So in that sense, I think it'll get used. I'm interested in the Citadels, not so much for the super big ones. I like some of the other structures that are being discussed, like the intelligence platforms and those kind of things. Those seem really cool. Can't wait to get more information about those.
Yeah, and they haven't really said much about that. The bigger structures have gotten most of the attention, but there's going to be a lot of little things that are going to be floating around space that are going to be worth some money that I'm quite sure people are going to want blown up.
Okay, the next one is, we touched on it a little bit and we'll marked it. CCP Siegel put out a dev blog talking about the roadmap again, because people are still like, despite it being brought up at literally every major EVE event for the past 2 years, I think, people are still unclear on what the roadmap is or how to find it. So she talked about it a little bit more. And she also brought in that CCP will be returning to expansions in a slightly different way. It won't be on a fixed 6-month release. They will continue to do the essentially monthly or a little bit more than monthly releases for smaller changes, but then they will group larger changes together in response to a lot of the forum rage about SAV being released and upgraded piecemeal.
I think it's not only that. I think although the new development cycle suits CCP a lot, and from the point of view of QA and getting rid of bugs and so on and so forth, and dealing with bugs, having this kind of iterative release cycle is wonderful from a software development point of view. However, I think they also realize that the idea of having an expansion with a theme and large amounts of changes, and then they can like bombard people with emails into their inbox and say, look, here's the new expansion. You should resubscribe because this is amazing. I feel that from a marketing point of view, that it's going to be better to move to something that's a hybrid approach.
Yeah,
I've heard a lot of people say that, but I'm just the other day, I had saved a picture of the PCU count from last year, I think it was. Or it might have been the year before. And you can see the boom-bust cycle, but what you see is the line continually gets smaller and smaller. And the biggest booms are for player events, like Asakai and BR, not expansions. So I feel like this is somewhat of an old wives' tale type thing that, oh, well, back when we had themed expansions, like, oh, so many people were coming back, and I mean, it's not actually true, and or at least it hadn't been for many years prior to now. It may have been true at the beginning of the game, but I think that, you know, it's sort of like a fondness of nostalgia for these expansion things that's not actually tied to real data in any meaningful way.
Well, I mean, we don't have the numbers. Obviously, only CCP have this raw data. But my feeling is things like Asakai, things like those big things that hit like major news websites and so on, and this many hundred thousands of dollars, that stuff, as much as it might bring some people back, that's the stuff that actually drives the new players coming in, I feel. At least that's my anecdotal kind of feeling on it, based on what people have said to me, my friends, who do not play EVE. Because those are the only times they ever contact me and say, oh, I heard about this EVE game that you play, you know, and this is amazing, and blah, 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 and tell me more about EVE.
I don't know. I mean, and Alec, I think you're right to a point with regard to maybe people attach a bit more to it than they should from a nostalgia point of view. But I also think that Fang has a valid point with regard to the marketing angle. Doing these smaller iterations that they've done have been a real boon for players. It's allowed CCP to have a much quicker release cycle. And there's no reason that CCP can't keep doing it as they've suggested they're going to in this hybrid approach. But being able once every 6 months or every 8 months or however they decide to do it, whenever expansion's ready, it's ready, they can come out and do a big flag waving thing. They have a new theme. They put out a new video that's dedicated to whatever it is. And it gives them an excuse to tout their brand. Because I think that when you look at some of the other online games, most of the time that you hear about them in the press is not when they're doing the small iterations that, honestly, a company should be doing anyway. It's whenever they have a big named theme of an expansion. And I think CCP's kind of woken up to that.
But at the same time, it's also a bit of a failure on CCP's part in the marketing side of things, because they could have had themed mini expansions like these monthly releases quite fine. And in fact, a lot of people were expecting that. It seemed like that's how it would go early and then just kind of fell away. I mean, you look at, I think maybe Celine, you're talking about World of Warcraft or something, but I mean, you can also look at games like League of Legends, who never had major releases.
No, but like, I mean, Guild Wars 2 is an example. I mean, they've only had like, I think, 3, but they've done a lot of iterative work in between those 3 big expansions. And each of the expansions they've put out have been like massive. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about in terms of marketing and whatnot.
Yeah, I think what Celine is trying to say, the key point that he made is this thing about the marketing products, the marketing artifacts, the videos, which cost time and money to produce and render and design and film, the scores, the background for the launcher. All those things cost time and money, and it's not.
I want the login screen back.
Right, and those things cost a serious. Exactly, like I used to love that feeling of when you had a new expansion that you would log in for the first time, and there would be a different musical score, and there'd be a different background image. And that might sound like a small thing, and it is not a huge thing, but it is definitely something that brought me an element of pleasure, and I'm sure it brought pleasure to lots of other people as well. And I think it gives you that feeling of the game is moving in a certain direction, there's something new, there's something big. World of Warcraft is a good example, because that's the extreme. I mean, Blizzard spend $5 or $10 million on just the cinematic movie, for their expansions each time. That's kind of the extreme end of things.
And I'm gonna be clear, I'm not opposed to this. As long as they stick with the frequent release for smaller updates and stuff, because that has been, like Celine said, just a total boon to players, whether they want to admit it or not. If CCP feels like this is going to be a more effective way for them to do marketing pushes, that's fine. My problem is that I feel like it obscures the underlying problems, which is the old boom and bust cycle of expansions was not a sustainable model for the game, and it really didn't help things in the long term. You had the boost of players that came in, and they would drop right back down again, and in fact go lower than before. You need to work on retention in general. You need to find more ways for players to get out there and do stuff that can escalate into really organic, unique stories, which seem to be what really brings people in better than the expansions in the first place. But mostly it's the retention thing. And sidecar to that, I think, is CCP needs to find a voice that can market Eve as Eve, not Eve as whatever new feature they're adding to it. You know, it's such a huge game with so much going on and so much like awesomeness to it. I'm a little worried that they're having trouble, you know, finding and expressing the value of Eve itself. And, hey, if you haven't tried this game out, you really need to. Rather than, hey, this game you never heard of has comets now. Come check out what comets are. You know what I mean?
I don't know what you mean.
What are comets?
comets are these things. Well, they're citadels now. Like, people that haven't played Eve don't know what the fuck that means.
There's people that play Eve that don't know what the fuck that means. I talked to one this afternoon.
You know, we need to... We, as in, I guess, in some ways, the players and CCP, just the entire Eve community, needs to be better at selling the game itself. And I think CCP would be wise to start focusing on retention features. And when they bring in this big expansion, they don't have, like, the vast majority of the players leave within a month or two after. And we want to keep these people around.
If we're broaching that whole chestnut of a topic of, you know, the retention of the new players, there it gets more complex, because one of Eve's greatest strengths is this idea that a lot of the game happens outside of the game. As, you know, as we all, as veterans, and I'm sure a lot of the people listening know, you've got Dotland, you've got, you know, communications thing, software, you've got forums, you've got all these API-driven tools that players are writing. A lot of the game happens outside the game. Now, that's great for the established players who are already part of the community and playing the game long-term, but it's actually a real problem for new players, because new players don't know about those things. All new players know is what they see on their screen. So I think that having all of that stuff outside of the game is also a problem for those new players, because those new players, they just want to be drawn in by what they see on their screen. They don't want to have to. Because when you're trying a new game, like if I say to you, oh, have you played this new game? And you go, no. And I'm like, oh, yeah, let's try this game. And then you're like, oh, I can't, you know, and you can't work it out. And then I say to you, oh, well, no, first you have to go to this website and you have to do some research on this. And then you have to go to this website and do some research on that. And then you can start playing.
But that's a misnomer in itself. Like, no, I mean, most of us have never done that. Like, when we got started. We got started and we were retained because, I'm going to guess, most of us found a group of other players that we wanted to keep playing with.
And also because Eve was and still is in many ways kind of the only game in town with this kind of scale and a single shard environment.
Yeah, so in my view, like, the successful Eve marketing strategy is based on two things. One is the vision of Eve, that it's single shard, it's ruthless, it's high risk, high reward, like the Texas Hold'em of online gaming. You'll never have a more unique experience that's so player driven, so open, and so amazing. And then the other part of it is when they get in, marketing the community itself to the players. So that it, and we've talked about it a zillion times, I think every CSM has probably talked about this at their summits, but like finding ways to remove the gap between a player coming in and when they join their first corp. Because players that join corps, and there's absolutely data to support this, players that join corps stay exponentially longer than those that do not. And it has nothing to do with the feature. There's tons of shit in Eve to do. And there's something for everybody, and if there's not, I'm sure CCP is actively looking at ways that they can add said experience. But, I mean, we've got a zillion kinds of PvE, we've got a zillion kinds of PvP, we've got stuff that doesn't require you to log in, we've got stuff that you can do outside of the game if you don't even feel like logging in. None of that is great if you don't understand the larger context, because Eve's inherent gameplay is in some ways kind of boring. You know, you for missions, you warp to the mission, you lock a red cross, you press a button until the red cross dies, and then rinse and repeat.
Red crosses? What are red crosses?
I'm tired of all this hate on red crosses, man. You say it like
red crosses are awful.
So disparagingly, man. You know, I'm tired of it. It's racist. It's red crossophobic. And frankly, it just doesn't belong here, so.
I would not advocate a red cross as president. Anyway, that's the thing. Eve isn't fun unless you understand what all that grinding is for, what you can use the ISK for. Some people find it fun just to
grind, yeah.
But not enough to keep CCP afloat.
Exactly.
So we've got to bridge that gap. Market Eve, the larger concept. Talk about the events in the world and why they're so unique, why they could never happen anywhere else. And then once that player actually tries the game, like, tutorial, slim it as much as possible, give them the essentials of what they need, and then part of the tutorial should honestly be finding a way to hook them up with a player corp, and accusations of favoritism and all that stuff be damned.
I think the best piece of marketing that CCP has ever produced was the recent This Is Eve video, the YouTube video. That is the best piece of marketing they've ever produced.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I have shown that to people that have absolutely no clue about Eve at all.
I haven't shown it to people.
You haven't?
I haven't, because they just contacted me. I didn't even know it existed. And I had like six emails. I had six emails in my inbox from people saying, "Is this that fucking game that you play?" And I'm like, "Yeah, this is the game." And they're like, "I can't believe it! I can't believe it!" So yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah, I've certainly shown that to more people than any other trailer. Like, I've always tried to show people the E trailer. Go, "Oh, isn't this cool? Isn't this cool?" But this is like, you know, the actual people playing it, you got to hear this. And then I'll even tell them that I was in it for one line. I'm like, you can totally hear me say this one word. Come check it out. And they're always like, yeah, okay. And then afterward, they're blown away. They're like, wow, can't believe you play that. That's awesome.
What breaks my heart is that was that type of thing with actual recordings from real people was supposed to be what they did for the Dominion trailer. And they decided not to do it. So, oh well.
Remind me,
the trailer was pretty cool,
was.
Though. To be fair,
it was.
The one with the bigger Maw fleet.
Yeah.
At the end, when the Russians show up, I mean, it was pretty cool. They did some really neat stuff with it.
But remixes were much better.
Yeah.
What are you you're warping? What are you warping for? It's gonna get fucking kited by hacks of battleships. They're just gonna fucking kill you. That was fantastic. Like, they should have made that the actual trailer. Just swap the videos out once that got made. But like, yep, you know what? This is a better vision. We're going with it. But the more changes they make that undermine that core Eve identity, I think the harder it becomes to do that. And that's like sort of the fallacy, or not the fallacy, but the trap almost of doing new player retention. This idea that new players are only going to be retained if they have more SP, more ISK, more of this in-game stuff. But that's not what makes a new player retained. What makes a new player retained is their experience, and that has very little to do with the ISK. I think certain changes, like removing the learning skills, were much better than increasing starting SP or increasing starting ISK. Stuff like, you know, making Tech 1 ships a little more stronger. You know, maybe they need to be toned, or maybe the T2s need to be tuned up, whatever. But T1 chips, much more viable now than they were before. Gives a player a feeling they can do some stuff. But more than that, it gives corporations that are working with new players more things they can give them and be like, hey, you can fly this Griffin, you can fly this Tristan, and you can own. We're going to teach you how. There's more tools there. But all that means nothing if they don't ever join that corporation. Rant over. So expansions are back. Generally positive about it. I really hope that it doesn't gut the monthly updates, that we keep getting the changes that we need to keep the game going. But I also do think we've sort of turned the corner where CCP has kind of proven themselves and we can sort of trust them to get back to these big expansions and not have things be terrible. Because God forbid they release a feature and then we don't get an update for 6 months again. That would probably literally be the death knell of the game.
Definitely.
Only other piece of Eve news we have... Well, there's two more pieces. One's more of a teaser. This one is cool, though. Rebalance of battlecruisers. It's happening!
Yes! Can I fly my Hurricane again? Please?
Apparently you can. It's getting the Articane is back in a big way. So, basically, all the battlecruisers are getting changed. Some of them are getting agility buffs, you know, little things like that, little tweaks like that to make them a bit more mobile. But then there are going to be complete changes to stuff like roll bonuses and the actual bonuses on the ships. Certain of the hulls are getting roll bonuses, depending on the type. So we'll go over them real quick, give you the winners and losers of this. I don't think there are any real losers, because they're all getting buffs, but certain ones are getting, you know, getting much, much more buffed than others. The Prophecy is getting a drone velocity roll bonus. So this is pretty much no change to the Prophecy whatsoever, which I think is fine. It's one of the best balanced battlecruisers out there. But basically it allows using non-sentry drones make that a bit more viable. And if any of you guys have something to chime in on any one of these changes, you know, just speak up. Harbinger is getting a further reduction to turret cap use, and is getting a roll bonus to optimal and fall off. Basically, this is making it a super zealot.
Yes, and Harbinger is my favorite battlecruiser, and I'm definitely going to be flying that one, because it sounds awesome to me. The cap issues have always been an issue on the Harbinger as well, and the cap reduction I'm very much in favor of.
And basically, if you don't plan on armor hacking, it's pretty much everything you'd want out of a zealot. Certainly the old shield zealot fit. I mean, I've seen the new shield Harbinger. It outclasses it in pretty much every way I could imagine. It's got more damage, more hit points, equivalent range. You know, I think armor-wise, the zealot is probably more durable, especially if you're sig tanking it. But certainly the Harbinger is a lot more competitive than it used to be. The Ferox is losing its resistant buff for a damage buff, and is getting a roll bonus to turret optimal range and fall off. That means it will have a double range bonus. It's getting a high slot removed along with a turret hardpoint and adding a mid slot. So basically, it's getting a damage bonus, but it's losing a turret, and it's getting an extra mid that you can presumably put an invuln field on, because it's losing the resistance bonus. This change is strange to me. It's basically, it doesn't change terribly much. Basically, it gives the Ferox like half a turret extra, and I guess a little more flexibility, because you could use the mid slot for something other than resists. And I guess it's giving it extra range. But
I'd rather fly Drake.
Yeah, me too.
With the Ferox, like, they've just gone, they've looked at it and gone, well, people aren't really flying Feroxes, which is true. And they've just thought, let's just try and think of something we could change to try and maybe see if people will then fly it.
I'm sorry, the only good Ferox is a Vulture.
Basically, they just made it a super, or an in-between an Eagle and a MOA. And in fact, it may perform better than the Eagle, actually.
What I'd like to know is, what range will a Blaster Ferox reach with Null now? That's what I'd like to know. I haven't bothered EFTing it or anything.
I think it's going to be pretty good. I think the more underlying question is, do you even want to run a Blaster Ferox now that it doesn't have the resist bonus?
I'll never see it coming.
Well, you've got extra power grid, remember, because you've dropped a gun.
So oh, yeah, that's true.
You've got the extra power grid fitting. So, yeah, that's the thing. Until someone sits down and EFTs it, which probably some people have already done.
Drake.
It'd be interesting to look at the HPs, yeah. Sorry.
Speaking of the lovely Drake, 25% roll bonus to missile velocity, so it's getting more range. It's getting a little extra grid, which is honestly not going to be that useful for anything except maybe the ham fits. And it's getting an extra 250 base shields, also not super useful. Basically, it's just a tiny little tweak to keep the Drake healthy compared to the other battlecruisers, which are all getting more range, which I'm pretty fine with. I've been kind of thinking the Drake should be coming back into the meta any day now, actually, judging by what else is going on with it. So.
And you can paint him red now.
Yep, there is that. The Brutix getting another range bonus. It's getting a buff to optimal and fall off. It's getting a little extra hull. It's going to get agility buffs to make it the most agile T1 battlecruiser, which is kind of cool. I don't think this changes much. I think the rail Brutix was good before. It's going to be much better now. The blaster Brutix isn't going to be changed much by this, so it's... Honestly, I think the Brutix probably could have used more buffage compared to some of these other battlecruisers, but we'll see how it plays out. Myrmidon's getting the same velocity bonus as the Prof, so I think that actually benefits more from the velocity bonus than the Prophecy did, because you see more mixed drone fits from the Myrmidon due to its different bandwidth. But that's great. That's fine with me. Slightest of tweaks. Cyclone, also getting a bonus to missile velocity. That's apparently getting some agility buffs, although evidently not as much as the Brutix. That's not much of a change to the Cyclone, but the Cyclone was also in a really good place already. The Hurricane. This is, I think, the biggest of all the buffs.
Hi, baby.
Yeah, the Hurricane's back in a big way. 25% roll bonus to projectile, turret, optimal, and fall-off. Extra grid, extra shields, extra drone bay, extra agility. It's like, oh.
I think someone at CCP likes that ship.
They must.
Well, I mean, they nerfed it like a year ago, so.
And they nerfed it out of the park, but I mean, they brought it back. It's now the strongest battlecruiser, I'm going to say pretty confidently.
The optimal fall-off thing is like, I don't know if you mentioned it, but it's like their general kind of design niche with them is to be able to reliably project damage at greater ranges than cruisers.
Yeah, but when you combo that with the artillery Hurricane fit, like, it's now basically the best battlecruiser sniper. Because the alpha strike on the artillery is just insane. And the tracking on the Kane is pretty good. It's going to have, like, lots of drones to fight people off with. Yeah, it's just fantastic. I think the Ferox is nice. It's going to have that extra range, which is cool, but rails in general are not as impressive as they used to be. I think a lot of people are hungry for artillery to come back into the fold. And the Harvey might actually be a good counter to these guys because of its usage for EM damage with the lasers. Which will be interesting to see how that plays out. Now let's see here. The navies are also getting an update. Harb Navy, roll bonus to optimal and fall off, extra armor, extra capacitor, extra speed and agility, extra drone bay. It's pretty much going to be exactly like the Harbinger, except it's going to have more, I guess, more flexibility. It's going to be a little faster, which is nice. The drones are going to be huge. Very important for your sniper fleet to be able to defend itself against interceptors and stuff. The Drake Navy is looking more like an actual Drake. It's getting a shield resist bonus instead of the 10% missile velocity bonus. It's getting the roll bonus. Extra grid, extra shields, extra drones, and lots of agility buffs, making it apparently the most agile Navy battlecruiser. That could be fun. Brutix Navy. Pretty much exactly where it's like, exactly like the regular Brutix, extra optimal and fall off with a roll bonus. It's getting extra drone bay, and it's getting slight hull buffs. That looks to be the least buffed of the navies. And the Kane fleet issue, it used to have 5%, basically a double damage bonus, turret damage and rate of fire, and now it's getting 10% bonus to turret damage and tracking speed. Which is interesting. It's going to have extra grid, extra shields, extra drone bay, and the roll bonus to optimal and fall off. That's interesting. I like that the Kane had double damage bonus. I guess it still does with the 10%. It's just not as good as the rate of fire. The tracking speed is cool, though. I like the tracking speed. That makes it a pretty good artillery platform. That makes it an absolutely lethal autocannon platform, if that's what you were going for. Could be interesting. Can't wait to get these into EFT.
One comment about the agilities. You know how they're getting the agility buffs, and you're talking about the Brutix. They've said it's the most agile. He actually is not the most agile, because there is still one battlecruiser that is significantly more agile than all the others.
Gnosis?
The Gnosis, yes. Mm. One thing I love about the Gnosis, and it's the only thing that I've ever found to be like a decent use for a Gnosis, is shield tank Gnosis. So agile. It aligns like a cruiser. It's great for chasing people with. Just a thought.
Yeah, I think the Gnosis is kind of conspicuous by its absence here. It's going to get left in the dust compared to these other ones.
Well, it needs to be, because it's the, you know, it doesn't require any skills. So, you know, in the from the Eve philosophy is if the ship doesn't really require any skills, like the noob ships, it shouldn't really be stronger than one that does require skill training to get into. But it does have insane agility. So yeah, try it out, guys.
Insane agility, insane lock time. In many ways, it's like a cruiser in battle cruiser form.
Pretty much, yeah.
Which I guess is a niche. I also like, it's probably the most flexible of all the battle cruisers in terms of fitting.
So we had the period of the Kame being like the OP battlecruiser and the one that you'd see all the time, to getting a massive nerf such that people just almost stopped using it entirely, other than sort of insta-canes and things. And now the Kame is coming back. Is it going to be number one? I think the Drake is going to be number one.
You think the Drake's going to be number one? I think the Kame will trump the Drake, to be honest.
I think that both of those ships. I'm glad that I never really was mad about the Drake. I always loved the fact that people could break into something and do some damage into kind of a tier ship like that. And I think with these changes, you're definitely going to see a lot of people do. I think that the Hurricane will require a bit more skill than flying a Drake. So, but I'm really looking forward to getting back in my Artie Kane.
I'm kind of a little bit sad for the possible death of the autocannon Kane. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it's... again, I'll have to EFT it all out, but with the new changes, I think they're really pushing the Hurricane to a artillery state, and it might just not make sense anymore to go with the autocannon version. DPS-wise, even. But we'll take a look. Certainly going to be interested to see if the Whelp King comes back. Be really interesting to see if the Navy Kane continues to be dominant in armor, or if it's going to be pushed to more of a shield fit, like the T1 version. I think that's going to be interesting to watch. And I'm very interested to see what happens with the Navy Drake. It's the only thing better than a Drake. It's a faction Drake. And finally, guys, the last piece of Eve news. There's a lot of stuff going on in the Fountain region. Or excuse me, not Fountain, Placid. Basically, a lot of big alliances have sort of condensed in Placid, Black Rise area. We're talking Snuff, PL, the former Syndicate Goons, NC Dot, Black Legion. All these folks are headed down to these particular two regions of LoSec for dank fights and hot drops. And I think it's going to be a really interesting place to keep an eye on in the next couple of weeks. We will try to bring you an update from that area on the next show, if we can. Depends, of course, if something has happened. But I think with all those elements in the area, I would say that it's likely there's going to be something cool going down. So we'll keep you in the loop. Real quick, I want to talk about our sponsors. We sort of skipped this because we went right into the talking about Eve news. But we've got EveBet, eve-bet.com. It's New Eden's premier betting service. You can bet on real-life sports with this. Great for NFL starting up now. They've handled hundreds of trillions in bets since opening, so they're a service you can trust. And if you don't feel like betting on a particular event, they also have more casual games like blackjack, slots, and that kind of stuff. They're always adding new stuff every week, from real sports to esports, so give them a look. It's eve-bet.com. All right. So we had a contract. It was Interesting. This is our first contract with Mercenary Coalition. And I will preface it by saying that we did win quite handedly. We did very well. Our employers quite happily. But it was a rockier road than the numbers belie. And I think it's probably worth talking about, especially since we have Fang and Celine here, to sort of go through the lessons learned and just the interesting experience of taking this contract. Because it was a contract that we took within like a week of joining. Like, we went right into this thing. And, you know, Noir and Mercenary Coalition have very different cultures and very different ways of operating. We had a very limited amount of time to get to know each other before we were sort of thrown into the fire against what turned out to be a pretty difficult contract. Our contract was against the owners of Space and Period Basis, Hams United. It was also against a Confederation of Pizza's strategic assets, although we never actually got there. We pretty much just fought Ham all the time. Ham and their Russian allies, who came out in force. It was... Oh, man. There's just so much going on in this contract. So the first thing was we had to deploy to Stain, which is a very deep 0-0 with the new Phoebe changes, almost impossible to get cap ships down to. So we were without cap ships. They had a cap fleet. That in itself contributed to kind of an interesting dynamic. They were more of a PvE-ing alliance, but you know, they had the numbers, they had the equipment, they had the benefit of having all the strategic jump bridges and stuff like that. We were the hardcore PvP alliance. We were kind of hampered by a lot of our pilots, especially in MC, not being used to operating under those conditions without having all their toys. You know, and Noir was sort of off in a situation where we weren't like complete masters of our own destiny. We had this new alliance out. We had to like, you know, make sure that we were keeping them in mind for how we were doing things. And they were, you know, with those things didn't always mesh terribly well. We had lost a couple of fleet fights early on, just due to be honest, I think overconfidence in engaging the targets. But then our logistics really came through. MC's logistics is extremely top-notch. We shipped down new ships, more counters to what they were doing, and eventually the Alliance got on the same page, and we showed a lot of resilience. We, like, took a fight, lost it kind of evenly, went back, reshipped, came back in, hit another target. They tried to fight us again, and we completely annihilated them. It was one of the most one-sided fights I've ever seen against what should have been a counter to the fleet we were in. We were in Serbs fighting at about 100, and they were in Apocalypses with triage support. And we annihilated that fleet. It was nasty. At the end of the day, Hams did successfully defend all of their important Sov. Some of their constituent alliances decided to dip out and take on new coalition members. They didn't like the heat that we were bringing, especially when it seemed like there was no end in sight, so they dipped out. But eventually the Russian numbers, the cap ship fleet that Ham was able to bring to bear, and some additional allies that they hired in to come in and deal with us, pretty much put things on a slow roll for the final week. We couldn't really do terribly much aside from get a couple kills. Like, certainly strategically, there was nothing to be done. End of the day, employer very happy. We killed about 42 bill, lost about 22 and a half, efficiency of 65%. Not bad, quite the comeback. We were in the 40s at one point. That was a really interesting experience. Bang, Celine, is there anything you want to add on that?
Well, I was only present for the first couple of weeks because I had to take a forced vacation. But the first, I'd say definitely the first half of the first week was a bit of a clusterfuck. There were mixed signals with regards to what folks were thinking they were going to do, people that didn't know what they were supposed to do. It was just, it was... Some of it was to be expected. I mean, MC is still a relatively young alliance in some respects and standing up. There's a lot of old players. There's a lot of newer players. And everyone's trying to find their way going forward together. And it works quite well most of the time. But this was a situation where we just had a couple of new corps join within literally 2 weeks of this thing starting. It was the largest contract and the longest contract that MC's taken to date. And it was also pretty much across the entire map. So between getting the stuff moved over via wormholes, via jump freighter, without capital ship support, because it would have been, I believe, 16 carrier jumps. So that was
something like that. We
could
have bought.
Crazy.
Yeah, looking in hindsight, we could have bought cap ships there and built a pretty decent cap fleet. I think the reason that we didn't was because I think about the first week and a half, due to disagreements with leadership, I wound up stepping down from the campaign commander position, and we didn't really have a commander in that intervening time to hop in. By the time we did get one, it was like, well, we're almost out now. But like, I think in hindsight, if we had planned it out a little better, we could have gone, well, okay, these guys are using caps. We'll go use caps. We'll buy up all the caps in Stain, which are actually, I mean, not the cheapest price, but pretty reasonably priced. And we could have done some stuff with that. But it would have also probably meant staying there longer term than I think it turns out we would have wanted anyway, so...
If this had been a longer term contract, longer than 4 weeks, if we had been down there for the specific reason of removing the entity completely from the region and had been given another long term, month long extension to do that, it might have been worth looking into. There were mixed signals initially from the client. I mean, as you said, initially there was a bit of Confederation of Pizza in there, but then that never materialized. I can tell you that when we initially showed up, I mean, the ham guys, they did quite a good job of rallying their numbers quite often, but they were kind of in kitchen sink fleets. They didn't have proper doctrines initially to even try, and even whenever they did, they brought the wrong thing. So when it was just MC and ham got handed their ass quite handily on multiple occasions, but their Russian friends down in the area, they were able to come up with about another 20 odd pilots on several key occasions, and that combined with the ham guys, we were quite often fighting 3-2 odds, and then a few occasions even 2-1 odds. So we had to be careful with what we were doing. And as a result of not having caps of our own down there, we were a bit limited in our response and what we could do in some scenarios. But, there's a fine line between, saying that, we succeeded and we really succeeded, and what's, propaganda and what isn't. From my point of view, the client was happy, and we did over 40 billion ISK worth of damage in 4 weeks, which is not bad. We completely shut down their ability to accomplish much of anything in any time zone, because even during the quiet times, we had people in black ops and in bombers running around in their systems, keeping them docked and otherwise occupied. And
well,
I know
to
that
be, to be clear, Celine, the terms were not to evict them from space. That was just like bonuses we would get if it actually happened. The term of the contract was to inflict max damage, and 42 billion for what the client paid, I would be pretty happy if I were him.
Oh, absolutely. And like I was just getting ready to say, there were some individuals, I mean, it's funny when you fight alliances like this that aren't used to engaging in any sort of real, any kind of real warfare. We had a couple of individuals down there that were showing up to fleet fights in Caracals versus Cerberuses. And when they got killed and they got potted, they lost their pod, which was worth like 2 billion ISK in mining implants. So it's stuff like that had to annoy the shit out of some folks. And it doesn't hurt.
And I will want to drop this little bit. We did do a lot of stuff with Sovereignty while we were up there, because it was a good way to get these guys to come out and fight. They're pretty relentless coming out and fighting off that. I gotta say, like, just like my experience in the test server with FuzzySov, this was awesome. This was everything you would want out of the Sov system. I think the difference was there was an active defender, where I think a lot of, you know, people that are engaging in this and are like, oh, it's so boring. It's because the defender isn't actually there fighting. The defender is there fighting? This system is fucking awesome.
I don't think in any of our fights...
It was a ton of fun.
I don't think in any of our fights that on multiple occasions there were between 40 and 50 people per side. I mean, we were having fights with 100 people on grid or less in many of these cases, and a lot of them were quite fun, and that's what the system seems designed to encourage.
Yep, and I think from their perspective, they were able to defend their space because there was like less than seven jumps between... No, it was like five jumps between their HQ and their most distant system. And they were active living in the space. So for you defenders out there that are complaining, like, oh, troll scepters, we were using way more harsher stuff than troll scepters. And these guys were on fucking top of it because they lived in the space. You're gonna have to get used to the idea that you have to defend your space if you want, like, as attackers... The system is designed to sure be boring, but be fast if the defender is not actually defending. And for defenders, it's supposed to be easy to stop people if you're actually around and active. And they totally were around and active, and it was totally fun. There was content every day, and it was just a blast. So, kind of gotta get used to this mental idea out there that, like, if the defender's not going to be defending, it doesn't matter if it's entosising or shooting a structure, you're going to have the same boring experience. But with entosising, it's going to be over in an hour instead of a couple hours. And if you're the defender, well, shit, man. Just go out there and fight these guys. Like, get that content you say that you crave. But if you're not around or you don't want to undock for anything, then there's really no helping you, is there?
Yeah, so brings me on to the things that I want to say. First of all, I want to say a big shout out to the Hounds guys, especially to the Danish corporations that we were fighting a lot in the EU time zone. So shout out to you guys. Well played. There were some good fights. There was a lot of action. Secondly, from a game mechanics point of view, I mean, a lot of this has already been said. Absolutely. If you live in your space, it's not all tiers and troll scepters and people just rage reinforcing your stuff. No, all you have to do is undock and stop it. And it's easy to do because you set your vulnerability timer. And these guys were living like Alexei and Celine were both saying. They lived only a few jumps away from the systems that we were hitting in period basis. So it was very doable. And the nerf to the speed, the 4 kilometer per second speed cap that CCP enforced that actually hit the server pretty much just as our contract was beginning, that had a noticeable impact because you can no longer use these 7 kilometer per second Cinnables, Omen Navy issues, etc. So your ships are not uncatchable. So if all you do is show up with a single scepter or a single cruiser, it's not difficult for an enemy who lives in that space to, you know, either chase you away or kill you. Secondly, the other thing that I think was really, that I learned from this particular deployment was the importance of geography in EVE, which has always been an important thing, but how even more important it is after Phoebe. I was speaking this week to a couple of friends of mine that used to live in period bases that know those systems very well, in particular XZ TAC, which is the regional, that's the regional connection to Stain. That has always been something of a fortress, I have heard, from people who've lived and fought on pure bases before. It's a very, very strong defensive position to hold. Now, after Phoebe, where your jump ranges are so restrictive, even for things like Black Ops, that the distance between the Stain and period basis is so large, it's so great, it becomes an even stronger position. So for anyone who's listening, who's thinking about either moving into Sov or is thinking about how they should consolidate their existing Sov if they're having problems defending it because it's too large, look at your geography. Look at the warp. Look at the light year distances between gates, and between systems. And use Dotland and do your research, because you will find that there are some systems which are essentially fortress systems. And I think that was a big part of why we had to work so hard. I mean, there were some other things that have already been discussed, but that was a big part of it. So from a games mechanic point of view, well done, I think, CCP. Because this really showed that the changes have changed the rules of the game and have made the game interesting and exciting and engaging. And it's not just people AFK and Troll Scepters. Not at all.
Amen. And shout outs to Ham. They're larger than us, about twice our size. Rucka, many times our size. But honestly, going in from the intel on them that we had, I did not expect nearly as much fight as they wound up showing. Admittedly, they were like, oh, we might want to surrender. Like, what's good about surrendering? Can we do that? And we had to tell them no. But once they realized there was no way to get out of it, they really, their backs are up against the wall, and they fought pretty hard. So, yeah. I mean, I don't want to shit on too much. They're not really a PvP alliance. They're just like living out in 0-0 Care Bears, basically. But they fought very, very well. And I gotta give them props for that. I wish more alliances, that were formerly pets or formerly renters when Phoebe changes went in, and now, can't really afford to be that anymore because guys like Pizza have their own problems defending Sov. I wish more of them were like that. And showed that kind of fight. So major shout-outs to him and Rucka.
Well, they did a good job of using, as Fang said, all of their advantages quite well. Once they realized that they were in the saddle, they Ham was about 800 or 900 members. MC is a little under 400. And their Russian friends, Rucka, were about the same size as Ham. So they pooled all their resources. They used the geography and the mechanics to their advantage, and they saddled up and did quite well, considering the fact that this is definitely not something they're used to.
Yep, and I believe I'm almost 100% sure this is the first major challenge to them since they moved into that space. They basically got handed that space because the previous occupants were not super active, and Pizza supported them moving in, and then no one has really attacked it until we got there. So this was their first major test. And props to them. Alright guys, I want to talk about another one of our sponsors, EveServers.info. Stop trusting random third parties with your data, guys. EveServers.info, you and only you have access to your corp and alliance information. It's a fully functioning, professionally built web server with complete API integration. It's simple to set up, simple to use. Anything you would need to rapidly deploy to do Eve stuff. I mean, we're talking TeamSpeak forums, Jabber, instant messaging like that, and just general corp management tools. They have all that stuff. Email eveservers@gmail.com for more info, and go, in fact, check out their site, which is conveniently eveservers.info. Go check it out and consider making the switch. That's it, guys. Go to declarationswar.com to participate in the show poll. We have one for every episode. And feel free to leave a comment as well. You can reach Noir via our public channel, Cafe Noir. We are going to have more recruitment information very soon, including a special event for Noir Academy. Stay tuned on that front. And as always, good hunting, listeners. Bye.
Into my mind.